Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Your city, your mayor. Melissa in the Morning with Mayor Joe Gannon. WICC 600.
So I know a lot of you are seeing it all over local news outlets. The video that is all over the place, the surveillance video, the cell phone video of a recent arrest that involved Bridgeport police. I am going to ask the mayor if he can comment on it, but I do want to make something I think incredibly clear, which is that you need to see every side of this video before you make a judgment. As far as I'm concerned, Mayor, if you were to ask my opinion, not that anybody is, I think this is exactly why police say in a lot of situations you should not be resisting arrest. I think it's incredibly clear once you see the police surveillance video that police were doing their jobs. But of course, the first thing that leaked over the weekend was a cell phone video from somebody on the streets. Do you have any comment on this situation? I know it's under investigation, but can you comment on it this morning?
Yes, certainly. I think you're right on the money with your view. I've seen a variety of the videos, some that were taken, some from body cam. I think they were quickly processed for permission to release, and I appreciate that by the authorities, both the city and oversight and others that have jurisdiction over the body cam video. So I think that's important. I will say this. I think the fact that we've advanced at least to the body cam and even dash cam is a huge move in, mm-hmm. in the right direction for transparency, for easy review, certainly after the fact, but in real time, what happens. Many times angles are particularly important, as you point out. But overall, this was currently a very difficult situation and a difficult arrest. And then I think it's compounded from what I hear, and I didn't get this formally, but I read it in the media, that the same individual was arrested, I think, yesterday for a domestic incident where, I'm just paraphrasing the news, that his mother or relative called on him for being certainly acting in a way that led to his being arrested again. So I think there's a lot of contributing factors there. Here's the thing. It is such heightened sensitivity.
Yeah.
Because of actions by police officers across the country, and this is not to brand in a negative way or see every, but it has caused us all, I think, to be more aware, to be focused on it, and to look at incidents that may appear, sometimes are, to be an action by police officer that's just, you know, wrong. We've seen murder, mm-hmm. obviously, recently in a it happened. So I think it's important that people continue to be diligent, whether you're spectators, officers in this instance, I think demonstrated as much restraint as they could in a difficult situation. There were moments there where you saw an angle on the video and you said, wait a minute, what's going on here? All I can say about the conclusions or judgment on it is we will and are doing, me and the city of Bridgeport, are doing their own internal investigation that'll be handled objectively and appropriately. And, you know, the chips fall where they may on that. There's nothing that I think your comments are probably the prevailing comments after seeing all the angles of
yeah.
the different videos and some of the information. But it's not conclusive, and I don't want to make a judgment or conclusion on it.
Mm-hmm.
On anything that's pending.
No, absolutely. And I just appreciate you commenting on it, Mayor Ganim. Like I said, I know this is what a lot of people are seeing on television. I have not really talked a lot about it on the show, not because I want to ignore it, but the fact of the matter is I do think, yes, we're living in a time where we have to make sure that we're bringing in good police officers. Absolutely. But on the other hand of things, let's not put a false narrative out there and just see one side of something and immediately think, well, there they go again. Like, that's not fair either.
No, and it's not. And it's too important for all of us. It's the foundation of, in many ways, the way we conduct a fair, hopefully open, free society. Now, you know, one bad apple, and I'm not commenting on this incident, but we've seen him across the country. We've seen him in the news. We've seen him in video where it's clear. And I've seen him in our department at times where it was clear.
Mm-hmm.
And those actions are much swifter. And we can't allow that to happen. This, you make a good point on training and on hiring. And we have certainly part of the training is de-escalation. Part of it is sensitivity with all angles. I think we even going to take a deeper dive, as I think other departments can learn from each other, as to how do we even expand on those elements of training and continued education within police departments across the country, but certainly in Bridgeport, we want to do the best that we can. So I appreciate the question.
Absolutely. I did want to say really quickly, I know I only have a couple of minutes, but I wanted to just let people know, as we were talking about the police department, there's a major effort happening in Bridgeport right now to recruit local good police officers to the department. And starting tomorrow, we are doing a new segment called Officer of the Week. And I have had already the honor of talking to a few officers in your department, Mayor, and they're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful. I'm very excited to launch this segment starting tomorrow morning at 8:20, and that'll happen every Thursday at 8:20. So I just wanted to let people know about that before we dive into the next topic, which I did want to, I'm sure you've heard this in your office, Mayor Ganim. I've gotten a lot of calls from listeners in regards to ATVs, four-wheelers, motorbikes. I have to imagine, because we talked about this, I remember, last spring as well. I got to imagine you're getting phone calls on this.
No question. And we're not the only city that gets phone calls, and it's not the first time or first time a year. And it's one of these nagging, and I don't mean to minimize by using the word nagging, but nagging quality of life issues, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with the good news. The good news is we haven't had incidents or accidents, which could very easily happen as a result of this. What we have is, I don't want to say terrorizing, but certainly loud, obnoxious, and disturbing noise coming from packs of individuals on dirt bikes and ATVs driving illegally up and down the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the problem. The solution is difficult because they are complete disregard and disrespect for what the law is.
Yeah.
They know, we know they're not supposed to be there, number one. Two, they demonstrate actions that are uncomfortable at times, even if you're just in a car and you get kind of four or five loud vehicles, motorcycles and ATVs pulling up, sometimes, many times ignoring traffic lights and traffic signals and other vehicles. And so that's the problem. The real difficult thing where I'm getting to is it's very hard to police, and it's not an excuse, but every city has this. Hartford at one point got federal support with helicopters to follow. We have we have things going on now that are surveilling and looking towards ways in which we can stop this. Oftentimes, you can't do it on the street because you can't chase them.
Right,
that's
right.
It's not acceptable policy, and it creates too much danger. So there are other ways in which you have to do it. I don't want to get into details on what we're working on, but they are working on it.
Okay.
I'm not happy with it. It's one of the things that I've complained about.
Yeah, yeah.
Had conversations with other mayors about this and the challenges that we have. So it's just one of those things, and I'm not saying it's one of those things we have to live with. It's not. But it's something that we are handling and have to handle better, and we're putting resources behind it and trying to curb as best we can this activity.
Okay. I know that Mayor Justin Elicker in New Haven is also working on that right now as well. But if people do have any concerns, can they continue to call your office and let you know, or is that kind of a waste
Absolutely.
Of time?
Absolutely. Okay. And if they have stuff, and this is the difficult part for people, sometimes they know and they're upset and they do complain. I appreciate that. We want to hear that. I want to hear that in our neighborhoods because that puts our focus on that problem. Sometimes we can solve it. Sometimes we can't. But if they have information where, hey, they store these 10 bikes, I see them taken out every day out of this garage at my house next door, or three bikes, and I know they go riding up and down the street because I can hear them, then we can get the bikes,
mm-hmm.
we can get the ATVs,
right,
and then or pictures where we can get some of the individuals and send a stronger message out.
Okay,
I think there is a feeling sometimes that the city doesn't care or the police department doesn't care, and that's not true.
Okay.
At least not from me and not from our acting chief and others that I've talked to. There is a difficulty. I hate to admit it publicly on the radio, but there's a difficulty in apprehending these.
Yeah, no question. And I also was given another number, Mayor Ganim, not to cut you off, but residents can also call 203-576-TIPS. That is the police department hotline. They're taking your calls as well. And we're getting some information as well, Mayor, actually from Rowena, saying that I guess the chief of staff has talked to the Bridgeport Police Department and they are initiating a task force. So, again, that's kind of in the works. So we're waiting to get more details on that. But that's great.
Right. I probably could have mentioned that. They are there is stuff going on behind the scenes. They are gathering and have been. We started last year.
That's great.
With limited, and I just got to be kidding, with limited success.
Yeah.
With limited success.
Yeah. Well, so, we're going to keep working on it. We do know that. And Mayor Ganim, I know we are running out of time, but I wanted you to be able to let people know about the mill rate. What's going on?
Yeah, the budget was passed, and I want to thank the city council members. They worked, if it wasn't on the radio, I'd say they worked their butts off. But they worked very hard on trying to improve on the budget that we presented, and they did. And they did a great job, and I told them that. I don't want to make it sound like we did miracles, but the mill rate dropped by almost 11 mills. Now, that's in part a product of growth.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, increase in values in the city of Bridgeport on properties. That's a good thing. Some people will see taxes. They're going to think we cut their taxes, and they may say thank you. The ones that got a higher valuation and the taxes went the other way, they're going to get mad and they're going to blame. But, you know, it's really a product in many ways of revaluation and of a strong effort, I want to admit, by the city administration and the city council to be sensitive to taxpayers.
Yeah.
We funded all the programs that we have in the past. Some we've exceeded, added more money to education, our city tax dollars to education, in addition to money that came from other sources, state and federal, and other programs that will be unveiling as we go through the next month. So I appreciate being able to put that out there. The mill rate is going to go down by 10.5 mills, almost 11 mills.
Wow.
From 54 to, I think it's 43.5 in round numbers. So if you want to do your calculation based on your assessment, that's the number you want to use. And we'll put that out in a formal, an accurate press release in the next day or so. So thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. Thank you for what you're doing with the interviewing of the Bridgeport police officers. I think that's a great way, not only for you to get to know them, but for people to get to know them through what you do at WICC. So thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate it as well. Yeah, they're really cool. They're a cool group of people, and I'm very excited to start sharing their stories tomorrow morning. Thank you, Mayor Ganim. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. All the best.
All right. You too. And it's our monthly check-in with the American Red Cross. Joining me now is John Godin, who's a Red Cross spokesperson. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, Melissa, and thank you for having us, as always.
Absolutely. So recently, the American Red Cross saw the lowest blood donor turnout since the pandemic started more than a year ago. That's pretty upsetting. That's pretty disappointing. John, what happened?
Well, I think what ends up happening is people are getting vaccines. They're getting on with their lives. And like many of us who've been cooped up in our homes for the last year, it's time to get out.
So they're kind of just like losing touch with the fact that we still need donations more than ever before.
Absolutely. You know, every 2 seconds, someone in this country needs blood. And I think us having conversations like this today, it reminds people who are avid donors or maybe prospectively new donors that the need is always there despite what's going on around us.
Well, and you know what's interesting, John, is the fact that May is also Trauma Awareness Month. And typically, you know, if we weren't in a pandemic year, typically I would see full force. I see Red Cross mobile units out at churches, schools, places of business. I mean, this is usually the spring is usually the time where you start to see a lot of donation centers really full-fledged working. And it's just ironic to hear the opposite in recent studies. That is interesting.
Yeah. Look, we are, as a state, opening up. We are, as a country, opening up. And it's time for us to get our message out that there is a need. There's still a need for blood.
And I'm wondering, John Godin, who is with the American Red Cross, is there any kind of misconception, especially with COVID vaccinations? Are they curious whether or not they can donate if they've gotten the COVID vaccine?
We've had a number of questions from folks who have gotten a vaccine. Let me just tell you right up front, if you've received a vaccine in the last 2-3 months, there is no waiting period to give blood as long as you are feeling well, you are symptom-free, and you're aware of the type of vaccine you received, you are eligible to give blood. There should be no misconception regarding that.
Okay, so you guys have been getting inquiries wondering if, in fact, the COVID vaccine would get in the way of donations.
That's correct. What I tell people is if they ever have any question regarding their eligibility to give blood, all they have to do is go to redcrossblood.org/eligibility. and that'll give you all the requirements that you have to see if you are eligible to give blood. But candidly, if you have the vaccine, you are eligible to give blood.
And we are talking again to John Godin, who's with the American Red Cross. Now, as I mentioned earlier, John, May is Trauma Awareness Month. Donors of all blood types, especially type O, are needed right now for hospitals. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. When we say type O, even especially O negative is a universal blood type. So if someone comes in with an injury and we're not aware of what the blood type is, O negative is the one that universally is given. So if you are O negative especially, we need that blood type to serve the needs of the hospitals around here who serve trauma victims, cancer patients, anyone that has a need for blood.
Okay. All right. Now, if anybody does want to schedule an appointment, or maybe they even want to put something together, like they would like to put together some kind of a donation center, they want to set up some kind of a drive, how do they go about doing that, John?
Well, there's different ways to sign up for a blood drive. So you can go to redcrossblood.org to schedule a time for a blood donation. You can also call 1-800-RED-CROSS to schedule a blood donation via phone if you're more comfortable with that. The other thing I encourage people, if they want to get more engaged in the Red Cross and potentially coordinate a blood drive like this, go to redcross.org. And it will direct you to our local region who can help coordinate a drive for you in any location that you serve.
Okay, fantastic. And I know I do want to just reiterate, John, before I let you go, just really the importance of type O blood types. My understanding is this is actually the most needed group by hospitals. Why is that?
You're a universal blood donor.
Gotcha.
So you can service anyone across any different blood type.
Okay.
I'm an O donor.
Oh, look at you. That's awesome.
Yes. They call me special.
But, you know. You are. Well, you are. They're at low supply for type O, right?
Yes. There's always a need for O blood because the demand is always high for that.
Wow. How many people, just out of curiosity, John, any idea like the percentage of people who are type O?
I think it's 7%.
Wow.
Yeah. Only
so 7%. You guys really are special. I'm not type O. I'm not special.
Yeah.
I make a lot of typos in my writing, but I am not type O blood.
Oh, that's very good. We hopefully you spell check, Melissa.
Yes. Well, thank God for technology and that they have that. 7%, though. Wow. That's not a lot of people. That's amazing.
That's correct.
All right, so there you go. If you're type O and you're special like John, you better go and donate for sure. John, always a pleasure to have you on the show. John Godin here with the American Red Cross. Thank you so much. We so appreciate it.
As always, we thank you for the 5 minutes you give us each month. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Again, John Godin, who's with the American Red Cross here on WICC 600. If you want to check out anything with the Red Cross, you can go to redcrossblood.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. That's 1-800-733-2767. John, always a pleasure. May is National Stroke Awareness Month. And to talk a little bit about this morning, neurologist Dr. Paul Wright, who is with Nuvans Health, he's the Senior Vice President and System Chair of Neuroscience Institute at Nuvans Health. And Dr. Wright, thank you so much for being here this morning. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Now, Dr. Wright has 25 years experience caring for patients with neurological conditions. And according to the CDC, stroke is one of the leading causes of death in the U.S. and a major cause of serious disability for adults. So first of all, Dr. Wright, what would you say are the first signs that you may be experiencing or you could experience a stroke?
Well, one of the very simple acronyms that we use is called BFAST. What we're looking for is B, alteration in balance, E, for eyes, look for any double vision, any loss of vision, F, for face, which is if you look and ask the patient to smile, if there's any asymmetry of their face, A, for arms, lift up your arms, does one drop, and S, which is speech, ask if to repeat a sentence, or if there's difficulty comprehending what you're saying. The last part, which is T, which is the most important, is timing. Call 911. Do not delay and do not say, let me call a friend over or let me call my physician, you call 911 to get to the emergency room as fast as possible.
Dr. Wright, I mean, are there risk factors for a stroke?
Unfortunately, yes. And one of the most important things is that 70 to 80% of strokes are preventable. And one of the major risk factors is blood pressure. The other one is diabetes, blood sugar, and of course, smoking, which we're all very familiar with.
And my understanding as well, Dr. Paul Wright, who's a neurologist, Senior Vice President and System Chair of the Neuroscience Institute at Nuvans Health. Dr. Wright, my understanding, too, weight could be a big factor in this, right?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, according to the CDC, over 70% of Americans are obese. And, of course, we need to take into consideration our diet. But one of the things that people don't realize is that we need to exercise. And the American Heart Association recommends approximately 4 days a week of moderate exercise. So we really have to be responsible enough to actually take care of ourselves by having an appropriate exercise program, but also have a proper diet.
So would you say, Dr. Wright, that, you know, when you say that stroke is preventable, you know, what about the cases where you have somebody who is in tip-top shape and is out for a run and something horrific happens, like either a heart attack or a stroke, which I've heard about sometimes? You know, in those cases, are those just sort of rare triggers that happened? Like, are there other things that we could be aware of? So, for example, if you don't have type 2 diabetes, you have no conditions with your heart, you're in pretty good shape and taking care of yourself, it still means you could fall in a category of having a stroke. So, like, are there other things we should be aware of or doing in case of a stroke?
Well, absolutely. The first thing is what we need to be doing. So many people, ironically, who are very fit and in good shape, don't usually see their physician. So unfortunately, high blood pressure is called the silent killer. Many of us don't know we actually have it. So what I always recommend is you have to see your physician at least once a year for the routine annual physical examination. But to your point of what you're saying, if you are healthy and everything is going well and something bad happens to you, what I always advocate again is to call 911 and get to the emergency room, because time is brain. For every moment that you delay access to care, we're losing brain cells. Nowadays, in the emergency room, we have stroke teams that are activated. At Nuvans Health, we have stroke teams in all of our hospitals that can treat, recognize, treat in an expeditious manner, where we can give clot-busting drugs. And in many of the hospitals, we actually have an interventional team. Now, before this seems like science fiction, where a catheter can be placed all the way up into the brain and pulling out the clot that's closing off a blood vessel, now this is fact, that this is done.
Now, Dr. Wright, before I let you go, I know you had said earlier in this interview, you had said, look, timing is everything. That's the last part of that acronym, is timing. How long would you say, on average, do you have when a stroke is happening to get to the hospital and get that taken care of? Like, what would you say is an appropriate amount of time that could save you from a stroke?
It all depends on the type of stroke.
Okay.
But what I always say is, don't be the judge of this. Just call 911. Because I don't want to have anyone misled by saying, well, you know, I still have up to 3.5 hours, 4.5 hours to be able to give a medication.
Sure.
So I can wait to see if it goes away. The problem is, what happens if it doesn't go away?
Right.
So that's
right.
Why 911, and leave it to the medical community to take care of you.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, Dr. Paul Wright, Senior Vice President and System Chair of the Neuroscience Institute at Nuvans Health. And again, Nuvans Health owns hospitals like Norwalk and Danbury Hospitals right here in our listening area. Dr. Wright, thank you so much for coming on this morning for National Stroke Awareness Month. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Welcoming to the show this morning, Jianjia Yi, who is the CEO of Springtide. Now, Springtide Child Development is actually a personalized holistic treatment center for children 2 to 18 years old with autism. And there's a new center opening up in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Jianjia, thank you so much for coming on this morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having us on. We're really excited to share our story with your audience.
Yeah, I love this concept because my audience knows I have a younger brother who's autistic. He's on the high end of the spectrum, you know, doing very, very well at 28 years old now. But I love to use my platform, my show, to talk about special needs and this demographic and be able to highlight places like Springtide and be able to talk about it. What is the mission there at Springtide?
The mission for Springtide is really to bring the highest quality of care to kids with autism. It's a really just fascinating space where right now almost one in 54 kids is diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and that has just completely skyrocketed. So 20 years ago, it was something like one in 150, and 20 years before that, it was something like one in 2,000 or one in 3,000. So the rates of autism have grown a lot. And so the fact that you have a personal experience, and I suspect a lot of your listeners will have a very close personal experience, given that almost 2% of kids have autism. But what's happened in this space as prevalence has grown, you know, a lot of great work has come into the space. Great advocacy, decrease in stigma, lots of people becoming more aware, great diagnosis. But the challenge that a lot of families have today is that even though they can get the diagnosis, when it comes time to getting treatment, it's really hard to tell the difference between a high-quality therapist and a mediocre therapist.
I agree.
We have this industry that, you know, we've got tons of great people who are committed to the space, but there isn't a ton of standardization because it is still relatively new as a profession. So what we're trying to do is really create this wonderful standardization. And so our model is, we have all of the therapists in one location. So, for example, at our Ridgefield location or our Trumbull location, we've got ABA therapy, we've got speech therapy, we've got occupational therapy. And that way, when families drop off their kids, we help coordinate a lot of great care across the different therapists so that there's no, you know, gaps in coverage or overlap in coverage. And we find that this yields a much better progress with the families and honestly just convenience. Like, you don't have to you know, drive your kid to three different doctors and schedule three different doctors and deal with insurance for three different doctors. So, yeah, that's kind of a little bit about us.
Yeah, and I think that probably sets you apart, I would think, Jaja. I mean, the fact is you're right. I think when you find out about a diagnosis, I just know from our family, immediately figuring out what is the best support system, it's hard to navigate a lot of times, and it sounds like Springtide is such an incredible support system for so many families. Now, I have to ask you, because I know COVID has impacted virtually every business, clinic, nonprofit, organization, everything. I have to imagine it also impacted you guys.
Yeah, it did. You know, I think to say that it was easy would definitely not be true. It was a tough year trying to work through all of this. But honestly, some of that toughness really, I think, for me, motivated me and I think motivated the staff, because you saw really the real need in this moment. So just imagine, you know, our typical family, right, that's coming to us. It might be a family that has people, parents that are working at home, trying to homeschool two other kids. And then also trying to dedicate the right amount of tension and structure to a special needs kid. And that was just so hard on families. Yeah. And so what we saw was that for a lot of the special needs kids, there was some regression because there was a lot of unpredictability, a lot of stress, a lot of environmental changes. And so it was actually really helpful for us to have this sort of a safe learning environment for all the kiddos to be able to come and work with us. And so we actually saw a lot of need and demand for it. Obviously, working through some of the challenges with COVID and everybody's schedules changing, it was difficult. But, you know, I think it made us feel really motivated for what we were doing for the families.
Jaja Yi is here, and she is the CEO of Springtide Child Development. And a second clinic has now opened in Connecticut. It's now in Ridgefield, Connecticut. The other one is in Trumbull. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about navigating, you know, when you have a child on the spectrum. I know a lot of people, Jaja, I would say that a lot of different districts actually specifically open in-person learning for special needs children for exactly what you were talking about, that it's already hard for children in general to feel connected when they're going virtual, right? So then, you know, kind of heightens that for a lot of kids who are on the spectrum, I would think.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know, because we're not talking about, you know, learning history or grammar, right? We're talking about potty training. We're talking about social skills. We're talking about kind of physical movements. This stuff really needs in person. And so why we've designed these centers and how we've thought about it is we really design centers that have kind of the optimal learning environment. We want to set it up so that it feels warm, it feels safe, it feels predictable. So when the kids are there in person, it really sort of maximizes their time and their impact working with their therapist.
So, you know, I'm curious, though, you know, Jaja, it's amazing that you guys have expanded. Only because, yeah. You know, in the pandemic, as you know, a lot of businesses not only shut down, but they had all these plans. And then 2020, boom, destroyed those plans. You guys have expanded, which is a beautiful thing. And I support that. I think that's wonderful. I am curious, though, are you guys planning to further expand?
Yeah, we actually what we're seeing is still really big gaps in care. So I would, you know, I'd be willing to bet the average person that's kind of listening that has experienced this will experience roughly 6 months plus wait list in order to get into therapy. So there is a pretty big access gap for families that are looking for therapy.
Really?
So there is a plenty of demand. So our first location was in Trumbull, our second in Ridgefield, and we're actually about to open a third location in West Hartford.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's so exciting.
Yeah.
So how many families do you guys accept at your clinic?
So each clinic will be working with about, say, 40-ish clients at any given time.
Okay.
We sort of think of autism as this lifelong journey.
Yeah,
and there are going
is.
To be peaks and valleys, right? Sometimes you'll have, you know, your kiddo is going to be going to a new school and will have a lot of learning to kind of work on. Sometimes it will be in a little bit more of a, you know, kind of steady state. And so we really think about how do we maximize when kiddos want to come into the therapy center, when it's better for being in the home, when, you know, kind of parent coaching is the thing that's really important for families to be ready for working with their kids. But at any given time, we'll have about 40 kiddos in the clinic. But, you know, that will ebb and flow in the way that we design the therapy for that specific child.
Jaja Yi, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I know you guys are having an open house on May 22nd. What is your website or your phone number for people to learn more and check you guys out?
Yeah, we would love people to come. Our website is myspringtide.com, so myspringtide.com, and would love folks to come. Where it's May 22nd, open house. You can meet our therapist and get to see our space as well.
That is so exciting. Jaja Yi, who is the CEO of Springtide Child Development, thank you so much for coming on. And where are you guys located in Ridgefield?
We are at 35 Copse Hill Road.
Okay. Well, welcome. We are so excited, and I look forward to having you back on the show again. Maybe when you guys open your third location, I'd love to have you back on.
That'd be great. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you, Jaja. We appreciate it.
It's time to go beyond the classroom and check in with the Discovery Museum. It's science you may not know on WICC 600.
So a lot of times when people go on space missions, they have this opportunity to bring personal items with them. The one that kind of stands out to me, of course, is Alan Shepard when he brought golf balls to the moon. And that's been like one of the most epic things when he first hit a golf ball. We've all seen that video before. But David Mestre, you mean to tell me that there was someone who actually brought with them a container full of seeds to grow plants or trees? What do you know about this?
Absolutely right. You see, on the same mission, it was the Apollo 14 mission that Alan Shepard decides, hey, I'm gonna bring some golf balls with me. It turns out that Stuart Roosa actually decided that he was going to partner with the U.S. Forest Service, and they hatched a plan that he was going to carry with him in his personal preference kit, which is the little bag that you can put anything that you want, that as an astronaut you want to carry with you to the moon. He was going to carry some seeds. And so the U.S. Forest Service, they made a little container, probably about the size of like half of a soda can, and they packed it with anywhere between 400 and 500 tree seeds.
Wow.
So they put in there sycamore seeds, sweet gum, redwoods, Douglas firs, and some loblolly pine trees, which I've never heard of a loblolly pine tree, but that's a tree.
Sounds cool.
It sounds really cool. So they put them all in there. And Stuart Roosa was actually the command module pilot. So he didn't get a chance to walk on the moon, but he was the one that got the astronauts back home. So half a million miles in round trip to and from the moon, and 34 times around the moon itself. They bring it back, and then unfortunately everything had to be decontaminated because at that time everybody was worried about, well, I don't know, weird bugs coming from the moon, and so they put it in a decompression chamber, and unfortunately the container popped. And so all the seeds came out.
Okay.
So they were exposed to vacuum for a little bit. And then in Houston, they have a group that tries to, well, let's see if we can get these seeds to grow. And the, you know, the scientists in Houston, they're not Forest Service people. So they don't really know how to grow these things. So they're kind of growing them, but some of them don't make it. And so the U.S. Forest Service asks for them back, and they start growing these trees in two places, in California and in Mississippi, mm-hmm. seedlings, and then they start handing them out during the bicentennial. And so in 1975, 1976, all these seedlings start making their way all across the United States. They made their way to Brazil, so there's actually some moon trees in Brazil.
Wow.
In Switzerland, they handed a couple to the Emperor of Japan, so somewhere in Japan there were a couple of these moon trees, and then we just kind of lost track of them. So we don't know where all the trees went. And so it's been the work of a scientist over in Goddard Space Flight Center, Dr. Richard Williams, and he's been trying to track the trees. Where did they go?
Mm.
And so he's only been able to really track today about like 70 to 80 living trees. So that's all that's left of the
wow.
500 seeds.
That's
now,
crazy.
Now it could be that they may be in somebody's backyard. In fact, he has traced some of them. Like somebody just took a tree and planted it in their backyard. They have it, you know.
That's so crazy. How would you know though that it's moon tree?
Because of what they were able to do, it's the right type of tree. It's the right age. And also, it's just, you know, that they just have a record of, yeah, you know, I'm going to pick up a tree, and I worked for the Forest Service, and, you know, I decided to plant it in my backyard. And that's what I did. You know, one of them ended up in a Girl Scout camp. So there's actually a Girl Scout. Yeah, a Girl Scout camp has it. The first tree was planted in Philadelphia to kick off the celebrations of the bicentennial. So that was in 75. But unfortunately, the tree didn't last very long. In the 2000s, it died. But they cloned it. And so they actually planted a cloned tree. And it died in 2019. And they're hoping to clone the tree again to see if they can actually get their moon tree back. But the big thing, though, is, and this is sort of like my personal thing, is Connecticut didn't get a tree.
Yeah, I noticed that in your long, long list of where the trees went. I noticed that. Where are we on the list?
We're not there. And that's partly because of the trees that went to the moon. They're not like native to us. We don't, you know, we need like a maple tree or like a black birch tree or something like that.
We make Douglas firs here Christmas trees. Like what happened there? Huh?
Yeah. They just,
I'm a little ticked off.
I am. So this is the thing. The thing is that we may get a second chance. And I hope our listeners are taking note on this.
I'm taking notes. What do you mean a second? This was what I was going to ask. Is somebody else doing this?
Yes, it turns out NASA is going back to the moon in the Artemis mission.
Okay.
So going back to, here's the plan. We have to hatch this right now today on WICC. We're going to hatch this plan. We have to figure out what kind of tree should go to the moon. And we're going to need to find the right seeds because the seeds have to be kind of small. You know, the redwood tree, giant that it is, its seeds are kind of tiny. And that's good because you can pack a lot of them in a little container. So we can't, you know, we can't send 500 walnuts. Walnuts are not going to do it. They're just.
What about dogwood trees?
I don't know. I'm gonna
look up seeds. Hold on.
We're gonna need seeds. They have to be small. They have to be able to pack in a small container, and then we have to pack a lot of them because you know not all of the seeds are gonna make it. And so if we can get ourselves that one seed that can make it, and so maybe what we do is we just kind of say that whoever is on the Artemis mission to return to the moon, if they just can happen to carry a little container filled with seeds from the Northeast, because these were seeds from like the California coast, and these were seeds that are mostly grown like sycamore down in the South. We need a couple of Northeastern trees in there, you know, especially like something that's like a Connecticut tree.
I agree.
And so this is our plan. So if we can, and if we can do this, then we can grow them, and then we can have a couple of our own moon trees, and that would be really exciting. And it is actually, you know, sort of a bit of the legacy of Stuart Russo, because Stuart Russo, before he was an astronaut, actually worked for the U.S. Forest Service.
Oh, cool.
He was a smoke jumper, and so he would actually parachute into forest fires and help fight the forest fires. So before he was a test pilot and an astronaut, he actually had this connection with trees in the forest, and he loved trees in the forest. And this was like a really cool thing for him to be able to leave as a legacy when he passed away in the 1990s, that these trees are still around. In fact, that Girl Scout tree, that's still alive. As far as I know, that sycamore tree in that Girl Scout camp in Indiana.
That's
camp
amazing.
Cook in Indiana, they still have their tree. So we need our own tree.
So if we have any tree enthusiasts or arborists who listen to this show, I know you're out there, please send me a message and I will get it to David, because it would be very cool to have some moon trees here in Connecticut. David, thank you for telling us about this. This is so neat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you never know. Maybe we'll get lucky and we'll get our moon tree.
I'll keep my fingers crossed. David Mestre of the Discovery Museum, thank you so much for Science You May Not Know. We so appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. You too.